And about my third year in, I asked a question that kind of changed the trajectory of my life. And the question was this: how much money can I make as a CPA? Tax professor looked at me and he said, about 60 grand a year. And I looked at him and I was like, that's it? I was like, I make that now part-time as a painting contractor.
What's the number one piece of advice you would give to, you know, a brand new deal maker?
And these guys would, you know, they'd call me up and say, hey, can you go pick up my Bentley and pick me up at the airport and let's go have dinner, right? So I get to spend time with these guys, right? And one of the things this guy told me, I said, what would you do differently? And he said,
a very warm welcome to the Creative Dealmaker podcast. I'm Carl Allen. I'm your host, and I'm going to be interviewing expert guests, sharing investor strategies that will completely and utterly disrupt the market when it comes to buying and selling businesses all over the world. Hi, I'm Carl Allen. Welcome to the Creative Dealmaker podcast. Got a very special guest today. He's one of my own. It's Dan Giordano. Dan, how are you doing? And welcome to the show.
I'm doing great, man, and I appreciate you having me.
I know. I was on your podcast not too long ago, I believe. I know we were talking about deals and mergers and acquisitions and all that kind of stuff, and I want to get into that. But you're a special kind of like dude, you know, and I really love you, and just kind of want my listeners or my viewers to kind of get to know you a little bit more, because you bring a lot of uniqueness to a lot of the things that we're doing, to the point now where you're on. You know, you're a major shareholder in one of my biggest ventures, and you're on my board, and you're an incredible resource and partner for us. But just give us the 5-minute backstory. Like, who's Dan Giordano? Like, where are you from? And like, you know, where are you now?
Sure. Yeah. So, I'll go back as far as, you know, I was born and raised in Philadelphia, right? And kind of grew up with my father worked for DuPont. So he always had these weird schedules where he would be off like 4 days or 7 days. So he's the type like me that can't sit still. So that's kind of like where I got it from. And so he started a painting contracting business part-time, and I kind of got roped into that. And by the time I was like 15, I was pretty much running it, you know, during the summers and after school. Yeah. Yeah, about 15 years old, I was pretty much running the show. And then, you know, I did like most kids, you know, went to college, right? And figured I'm not going to do that for the rest of my life. I'm going to go become an accountant, right? And so I went to school for accounting. And about my third year in, I asked a question that kind of changed the trajectory of my life. And the question was this: how much money can I make as a CPA? And the, you know, tax professor looked at me and he said, about 60 grand a year. And I looked at him and I was like, that's it? I was like, I make that now part-time as a painting contractor, right? And I was like, so I started questioning my life choices. So I kind of like, you know, really started to look at my third year in as like, do I really want to do this, right? And I had an interest, obviously, in a lot of different things, you know, fitness, and, you know, tried a few things, you know, after the painting career. And then wound up back in what I knew, right? But basically took painting. It was my first niche. I went into Victorian and historic restoration. Some big areas in the Philadelphia area and New Jersey area, a lot of old historic homes. And I just like the history of them. And that was my first niche, right? So I took painting and went into that specific space, you know, so by the time I was 21, I had, you know, 25 employees, and pretty much the largest company doing what, you know, I enjoyed doing at the time, right? And so it was a fun run. And, you know, I was fortunate that in high school also, I had a college professor. His name was Mr. Swider, and he taught in high school as well. And he taught accounting and he also taught marketing, right? And in his marketing classes, he always talked about differentiation, right? He always talked about, you know, doing something different to stand out. And yep. So when I started my contracting company, I, you know, my trucks long before Service Master were yellow and that bright turquoise color, right? And you know, we stood out. All my guys wore professional polos. We just really stood out and did things a lot differently than everybody else. And then I took that into everything else I did, you know. And then magically, you know, 1998 was the first time I got to sell a business. You know, so I sold that company and I learned what not to do, right?
Tell me about that exit. Like, how did it materialize? And then what did you go through in that process?
Sure. Yeah. So there was a competitor, right, that I had that, you know, that we were kind of friendly. You know, he would subcontract some work for me from time to time when he was slow, and basically came to me and I said, look, I'm going to be moving to Florida. And I'm thinking about selling. There's a couple other people that are interested. But you know, I want somebody I know that I trust, right? That's going to take this over because my name's on it, right? And so, long story short, you know, I got some cash at close, right? But also, you know, it was a monthly payment type scenario. Seller financed it,
and probably about an annuity deal, right?
Yeah, yeah, exactly. So it was like an annuity deal long before I knew what any of this stuff was, right? Yeah, and you know, it was a different type of scenario because, like, you know, about 12 months in, he made some decisions that kind of cut, you know, I had some big developer work as well that, you know, they were buying into me, right? So I would fly back up once in a while and connect with them to make sure everything was on board, you know, and everybody was okay. But it was, you know, there's a lot of lessons in that of like what I could have done differently, right? And, you know, how I could have structured it. So it didn't go totally as planned, but it was my first experience with doing that. So obviously, yeah. I don't expect everything to be perfect, right? So
no, but so. isn't it interesting, though, that when you first become a seller of a company and you learn a lot of lessons on the sell side, you're able to translate those lessons into being a more sophisticated buyer. And I think part of that is understanding the process. And right. The other part of that is learning to live with the emotional psychology that you go through on a deal, whether you're a buyer or a seller, right?
Yeah, yeah, exactly. Yeah. So once I got, you know, through that and I came to Florida, I kind of got sucked right back into the construction industry because that's what I knew, right? So, you know, I happened to meet a decorator at a party I was invited to the first week I was here. And next thing you know, I'm working along A1A and all the multi-million dollar homes on the beach. And, you know, I was fortunate again to start building, you know, another company with hiring employees, but then something magical happened in, you know, 1999. It was, you know, we were expecting our first child in 2000 and wow. I started to question my life choices, right? I started to say, well, I don't want to work 7 days a week, right? I was like, what could I do differently? Cause I'm, you know, I'm in the day to day, I'm trying to figure this out. You know, what was interesting is I had a client at the time, the guy had like a $400 million exit. It was a big construction company he sold in the Midwest. And, you know, I just would always get friendly, like call it podcasting before podcasting was a thing. Like I would always just get to know the clients and really just like everybody was going with their hand out to get their checks to get paid. I was going just asking for insights of like, you know, how did you get where you're at today? And these guys would, you know, they'd call me up and say, hey, can you pick up my Bentley and pick me up at the airport and let's go have dinner. Right. So I get to spend time with these guys. Right. And one of the things this guy told me, I said, what would you do differently? And he said, I would give it all back if I can get my son back. Cause his 30-year-old son died of alcoholism. Cause while he was building this massive, you know, this massive empire, you know, he wasn't home. Right. It wasn't part of the kid's life. Right. And so I, you know, kind of really struck me and I was like, okay, doesn't mean you need to live like a pauper's life. Right. but like, what could I do differently? Right. And so I started playing around online and I kind of fell into the affiliate marketing world. That's how I got into the internet marketing world.
Yeah.
And, you know, and that's where it started. I started that journey into, you know, internet marketing, lead generation. And, you know, then eventually, you know, was the backbone behind a personal development company for 10 years, with partners and, you know, left that in 2011. And then had a few different types of ventures that I was in, you know, in the financial services industry, just taking my marketing experience and, you know, trying to figure out like, what's the next thing I'm going to be involved in.
Yeah. Interesting. Right. So you've had like a big construction home services type background, and then really for the last 20 years, I'm guessing you've really kind of delved into the marketing world. And I know that marketing is like anything marketing related is really your kind of buy box. So let's start to talk about some of the deals that you've done. I know you've just closed on a really big agency deal. I've seen a number of your other acquisitions that you've done. I think you did an e-com brand in the sports right. world, which, you know, big kind of like big thing of right. marketing. Like, even though I'm a Brit, you know, I'm crazy about basketball. It's like my thing. It always has been. But yeah, let's talk about some of the deals that you've done and how you actually did them.
Yeah. So, so with the sports e-com store, that was an interesting deal because the guy had bought it and just kind of, you know, did what some people do. They don't really know how to run it. Right. And, you know, got distracted with another project. And, you know, at the time that business was doing about, you know, 1.3, 1.4 a year. And you know, then he let it slowly dwindle, right? And then stopped running traffic, right? And then was trying to sell it for $250,000 to get his money back out of it. And I just kind of let it sit. And I was like, dude, it's not really worth anything, right? You know, it's like, aside from the sports vendor relationships, right, and the database, you know, that's really, you know, the only value. So finally, you know, just through another partner of mine, we were on a conversation with him one day, and he's, you know, it was like 4 months in of different conversations throughout the time. And I just get on a Zoom and I just asked him, I said, what do you really want? Like, what would make this a win for you? And he said, you know, I'm just tired. Like, I just want to be done with it. I'm tired of paying for all Shopify and paying for all these fees. He's like, you know, if I can get 10 grand for it, I'd be happy. Right.
Wow.
And I was like, dude,
$250,000 to 10 grand.
Yeah. So I said, done, you know, I'll get my attorney to draw up the paperwork and we'll handle that. Right. So that was the first deal, right. That got over the line. And, you know, when I look at that is like, I was watching all these different things out there in the marketing space. And, you know, obviously your famous words are, you know, you should make a t-shirt for this one too, stay in your lane. Right.
Stay in your lane.
I was like, yeah. Cause I was trying to, like, when I started this journey with you, is like, I had a coffee company under contract. Right. I had, you know, everything but marketing company. Right. Yeah. Cause I was trying to, you know, trying to avoid, you know, doing it. But ultimately through what I started in with the coaching business that I had, I hired an agency. And for the first time, and it's like kind of like hiring a painting contractor for me. It's like very painful, right? To let somebody else do that work, because I'm, you know, kind of a, you know, a little bit of a stickler with that kind of stuff. So I was like watching what was this agency was doing. And I said, you know, probably about 3 months in, I was like, dude, like, you know, this is a friend of mine, very high profile in the internet marketing industry. I said, dude, if I didn't know you, I would have fired you month one, right? I was like, I love you as a friend. I said, but you suck as an agency, right? I was like, so what it did though for me was it drove me to say, okay, I'm going to go fix my problem, right? Yeah. I'm going to go acquire an agency, right? And that's what I did. It was like, I literally pulled a list, did the direct mail thing, which I resisted because I'm a paid ads guy. And I was like, I'll just run paid ads, right? And I was like, all right, I'm just going to do what Carl says, send letters, see what happens, right? And I just happened to catch the guy, you know, for this business that, you know, just happened to be perfect scenario where, you know, he's checked out, you know, 3 years, number two guy was already running a day to day, had all the makings of, you know, the ideal buy box for me. And you know, was able to get that deal over the line, over the course of several months, right. Not without obstacles, right.
Definitely. Yeah. Talk to me about some of the obstacles, because I think a lot of people have this misconception that, you know, to be a deal maker, it's always plain sailing, right? It's always like simplified, but it's not, right? Like Wall Street deals, which is where I came from originally, they do tend to be like that. It's a lot more mathematical and process driven. And there isn't the emotion, there's ego in Wall Street deals, but there isn't the emotion, the psychology. But when you get into a Main Street deal, you know, any deal less than, you know, $10 million in revenue, really the biggest challenge is dealing with the seller's psychology, right?
Right.
And that emotional roller coaster. And as this wasn't your first deal, obviously, but then a lot of people come in and it's their first deal. They've not been through that emotional journey as well. And like, it reminds me of like having kids, right? Like when my first, my boys are 26 and 15, right? When my 26 year old was born, I can remember I was so nervous and anxious and worried because I'd never been through the process before. And then once it was said and done, I'm like, okay. When the second guy came along, it was like, man, I know what's going to happen. It's easy. I wasn't worried about it. And I find that is the same with deals, right?
Right. Yeah, definitely. And I think, like, you know, there's a lot of lessons, like even in how I structured this deal, like there's some things I look back at, I'm like, man, I should have done this a little differently. But you know, it's learning, right? And it's like, you know, there's no perfect scenario. But for me, you know, the biggest thing that I recognized, because at the same time we were working on that other deal, you know, with KOD, you know, that was, you know, interesting with the broker, right?
Yeah.
So while I was on those calls experiencing that, there were some things I was gleaning from, like, okay, I could have done this differently, because the challenge that I had was, because I sourced this deal directly, there was no broker involved, right? And the seller checked out from the time I signed the LOI. He just handed it to his attorney. And the attorney was basically holding the ball on everything, right? And he was the one that actually held up the deal. He's the one that was causing all the issues, right? Because the seller was just like, I'm doing my thing, you know, I'm out, right?
Yep.
And so So it was a big challenge to get it over the, you know, over the line. It took three more months than it should have, simply because the seller's attorney just was, you know, not a nice guy, and just really just, you know, not motivated to get a deal done. Right.
It's crazy. This blows my mind, Dan. Right. And this is something like, let's talk about this, because like, if you look at, you know, in any transaction, right, typically you've got a buy side, you've got a sell side. You absolutely always need to have an attorney on both sides of the deal. And right, most of the time, you're going to have a CPA on both sides of the deal just to check financially everything's like done and dusted. Right now, these guys, their job, their outcome is to transact, right? Why do you think there's so much like resistance? Is it ego? Like, what do you think it is, right? Like, having done all the deals that you've done, and having experienced a lot of that, like, why do you think they can be so like just difficult? Like our attorney in KOD, he's Justin, he's amazing, right? He's like, he's incredible. But nearly every other attorney I've ever met, they're not like that. Like, why do you think that is?
Well, I mean, I think part of it is they're not, you know, one, they're not the type of attorney that should be even doing these types of deals, right?
Yeah,
I think that's a big, you know, a big thing is like my attorney, you know, is specifically for acquisitions. He does do some trial work for some other stuff, but this is his main thing, right? Yeah. Whereas this attorney was just like, it was a guy that he'd been using for years. He did not want to use anybody else, right? And I actually told him, I said, dude, I'll pay for a new attorney, right? I said, let's just get this done. This guy is dragging his feet. We're not getting, you know, he's like, he was busy in trials. He had no time. Like literally I had sent him, in May 1st, April, I sat in the office here and told the seller asked me, he's like, how fast can you close? I said, 30 days. Right. And he said, okay, fine. Got my attorney to draw up all the paperwork. Everything was in his inbox, ready to go. Attorney does not respond until 2 days later and says, this is to acknowledge I've received the agreement, but have not reviewed it and will not be able to until June.
No,
this was May 1st. Right?
Seriously?
Yes. And I'm sitting there, my attorney calls me, he's like, what the fuck is going on here? Right? Like,
that, you know, is ridiculous. Like,
yeah. And four so weeks. Yeah, so my attorney, like, so we waited 6 weeks for this guy to respond, right? And then finally he came in and said, well, I'm going on vacation, right? And I'm going to be away for 2 weeks, right? And my attorney's like, listen, we sent you a 12-page contract. He sent back an 80-page contract. And my attorney calls me and says, we're not buying Chevron here, right? And like, you know, it's like, what is this guy's problem, right? So, but it, you know, it just, I think part of it is because they're not, you know, this isn't their only baby that they're focused on, their only thing, right? So I think that's part of the issue is like, if you find an attorney that actually has, you know, experience in acquisitions, right?
And dedicated to that, right?
Yeah, and dedicated. I think it's, you know, the specialty that, you know, a lot of attorneys don't have. They're all over the board doing a bunch of different things, right?
Yeah, and I think this is a really good point, actually. Like, I think picking the right type of attorney, you don't want like a gigantic firm where they're going to charge you, you know, they don't even start looking at deals for less than 100 grand in fees. But you don't want the local ham and egg guy that's handling divorces, wills, real estate, and will do a bit of M&A on the side. You kind of want somebody that's dedicated to mergers and acquisitions or corporate law, and they have like a little bit of a team around them, right? It could be a one partner firm, but at least they got a paralegal, they got a secretary, they got somebody that can kind of keep the wheels moving. And I've got, you know, my perfect guy. So I have two attorneys that primarily do all of my legal work. I've got Justin, who looks after KOD and a lot of other stuff that I do. And then I got James, who is not just my attorney in eComfolio. He's actually a shareholder and he's, you know, he's on the board of that company. But I remember when we were shopping around for attorneys and my business partner, Ross, actually knew James from before. And he looked at it and he's like, man, this like is so cool. Like, can we do a deal where let's do like crazy discounted fees, but I want a piece of the action, right? And so he's been amazing. So I think getting the right advisors is key because they can gum up the works. Like you build this great rapport with the seller, you structure a really great deal, everything's all laid out. You want to close quickly because you want the business. The seller wants to close quickly because they want to get out. Why should advisors get in the way and kind of ruin it? I'd like to think it's just about they want to make more money, so they want to spend more time, i.e. 16 to 80 page contract. But I think a lot of it can sometimes be around like it's ego, isn't it? It's like, well, lawyers, definitely, like, they're suiting up. Yeah. They want to go to war with each other. And that's why it's great to have a good relationship with a business owner, because you can get rid of all that noise and just deal with a lot of those commercial points.
Yeah, no, it definitely is an interesting thing, because I just think about the legal fees. Like the guy, his attorney got paid four times more than my attorney did.
Yeah. And that presumably came out of the guy's closing payment, right?
Yeah. Yeah. Yeah, exactly. Came out of his side. But it just was like, you know, I was like, why is he getting paid that much? My attorney did all the work. Like, I actually felt bad for him. Right. Yeah. Fortunately, I keep him busy. Right. It's like, but
yeah, it's always been a goal of mine to buy an M&A law firm, because I probably spend $500,000 a year on attorney costs. Right. So would it make more sense? But there's a lot of restrictions buying a law firm. At the very least, you got to partner with a lawyer that's part of the bar and, you know, can be your person there. But as you know, in our KOD roll-up, we're closing soon on a CPA firm, right? Mm-hmm. Imagine what we're going to do with that business. We'll 7X that business in 1 year. Just can you imagine deploying that CPA firm into like proteges and echelon deals and like all the real estate investors we've now got as part of our community? So one of the, I said to Jeremy literally last week, I'm like, Jeremy, like this business will break. Like seriously, it's a great business, but like we're going to break it with the scale we can give it. So we've actually found a bolt-on, which we can buy very, very creatively. So we can almost triple the output capacity of that, which is really, really cool.
That's awesome.
Cool. So what else are you up to right now? I know, you know, you bought the agency, you got a bunch of other deals, you're on my board in KOD. Like, you know, what else is going on for you right now?
Well, I think, you know, the big thing for me that I recognize is, what's funny is that the problem I thought I was going to solve by acquiring this agency, this agency is not like built for the world we come from with the coaching space, right? They're more a local marketer, lead gen, and they work with some $1 billion brands. They work with, you know, local mom and pop, you know, type businesses. But what's interesting is first couple months here, where I started to see this come together, and I just call it the Ryan Reynolds model, right? Is basically, you know, aside from like, I'm not a movie star, but what I know is that these guys came in that are, you know, part of a moving brokerage, right? And it was the first, like, literally we structured a consulting for equity deal that's a multiple six-figure deal, right? That they're actually paying for us to build everything out, to manage it, run the entire thing, and bring in the online side, because these guys are doing some significant numbers nationwide without a website. It's all call centers, right? And they're like, what could we do with a website? And I'm like, well, we can disrupt the industry, right? And they're like, that's exactly what we want to do, right? So we did a consulting for equity deal 60 days in. And what's fascinating is at the Protégé event, because I sat next to Ilya, right?
Yep.
And he's a developer, right? So we were talking, we cut a deal with him. We signed it yesterday, right? So we brought him in to take a piece of the equity as well, right? And have him be the developer on board to run it. Cause I told him, I said, I want a team on board that actually has a vested long-term interest. I just don't want to hire people overseas to just build it. And then I got to keep, you know, babysitting them. Right. So.
Yeah. And that's really smart, Dan. And, you know, a lot of people have a limiting belief around that, around partnering with other people. And I've been pounding the partnering drum in Protégé for kind of 2 years now. But what I'm really proud about the Protégé community is about 1,100 people in it now. And when I first launched it, and you were one of the first people that came in a couple of years ago, I'd say 1 in 10 deals that would close would be partnerships. Now it's more than 50%. Like, it really is. Like, every deal I'm looking at now, either it's a tombstone that we send out or people post in our groups, hey, I closed this deal. They're all kind of like partnering. There was a great deal that closed yesterday. I think it was Murali and Samir, right? So Murali and Samir, they're both from the tech world. They bought an agency, And I don't know, man, just it really makes me proud, like, to see these people, because it's a 1+1=3 model, isn't it? You know, like we can't all be amazing at different things. Like for me, for example, you know, I'm a visionary. You know, I'm the best in the world at doing deals and raising capital, but I'm not an operator, right?
Right.
I'm not an operator. I know a lot about marketing. I know a lot about numbers, but there are far better people than me in my network that can do that stuff. So I'd rather partner with those people, give them a piece of the ownership, because then that psychologically changes them, because they're a co-owner of yours and they're part of the team. I think they just lean in harder, right? Is that what you found?
Right. Yeah, definitely. And I can say, like, even, you know, working with Steven, you know, for the past 6+ months, right? It's just, you know, we have a deal under contract now. We've had a few here and there that you know, got under due diligence that didn't work out, right? But, you know, it just, to see how him and I have worked together, it's like we click on all cylinders. Like, you know, I told him, I said, you can get us on a call with any seller. They all want to sell to us, right? Yeah. You know, him and I together is like this power team that we just kind of naturally fell into. And, you know, the Protégé event was the first time I actually met him in person, right? We were working together for months, you know, before actually physically meeting, right?
Steve's incredible, right? Like, yeah. He really is. Like, what I love about Protégé is people come into Protégé from, like, all walks of life. You've got absolute rookies that don't know anything about anything. But I vet every single applicant that comes into the program, because I want to control, you know, the quality of the group and the dynamic and the culture, really. So often I look at people that come in and, you know, they got no deal experience, but they have a solid industry background. But they've got the hunger, they've got the ability to learn, they're a noble capitalist, and they're going to be coachable. So I let those people come in, right? And typically those people do very, very well. But then on the other side, there's guys like you and Stephen that I think you and Stephen are very different. You've obviously got a massive tenure in your business career. You've done deals before. So you're coming in at a much higher level. And you've got Stephen, who was an M&A guy, like, in a large company, right? And has done tons and tons and tons of deals, but he's still learning a lot and benefiting a lot from the community and the sort of partnerships, you know, right, that we're building, right?
Yeah. Well, and I think, like, the, you know, for me, it's always been about, you know, being in the martial arts. When I got my black belt, one of the masters asked me, he said, "What did you learn?" And I, you know, out of testing for like a couple of months of beatdowns. And I just looked at him. I said, "I learned, I don't know a damn thing." Right. I said, you know, there's always something to learn. Right. And, you know, so for me, it's always been that way with, you know, anything that I've come into, it's like, okay, I want to act, you know, I'm a newbie, right? It's like, I just act as if I don't know anything, because there's always something to learn. So if I come in with an ego thinking that, you know, oh, I know better than this, you know, person or whatever, like, it just isn't going to work out. Right. And you see that with people that come in that do have more experience, that think they know better. It's kind of like in sales, they always say hire younger, hungrier people for your team. Right. Yeah. Because the older guys are kind of set in their ways. Right. And gals, right. They get set in their ways and they're not coachable. Right.
Yeah.
So it's the same scenario. Right.
But I love that about Steve, right. He's coming in, he's doing all this really cool stuff, but, like, he gives so much back to the community. It's why I call on him a lot when we're doing these things. And so one thing I've learned about you today, which I didn't know, is, like, that you were, did you do karate? Was that your?
It was that Shaolin Kempo karate. So it's basically all three systems, right? It took me 6 years to get my black belt. So
yeah, so I was Shotokan, right? So I did my black belt, gosh, 1992. I got my black belt. And I was talking to somebody about this literally yesterday, right? I've only ever had 2 fights in my life in a street, right? I've had thousands of fights in a dojo. I was in competitions. Like, you've seen my nose. Like, I've been hit a few times. So I'd never fought in my life until I was like 19. And I went to college. And, like, one of the first nights I was there, some guys decided they would beat me up, right? And I didn't have any skills, right? So what did Ninja Carl do? Thought, well, how can I learn to defend myself? So I started taking karate classes, loved it, loved the discipline, love a lot of my mindset training, a lot of my mindset and beliefs have come from like doing karate. Like, and I remember for the first like 3 months, you know, I would come home, my knuckles would be bleeding because they used to make us do push-ups on our knuckles on a concrete floor, right? So my knuckles would all be raised and like you know, I would have like massive bruises on my arms where, you know, you're just repetitively blocking.
Right.
So did all that, did my black belt. And then kind of I left college and I went to work on Wall Street. So you don't have time to do that stuff. You know, you're working 20 hours a day. So I haven't really done it. But then a few months later, I was out with some buddies and we were in a line waiting to go into a bar, right? And these three or four dudes like decided to kind of jump the queue. And one of my buddies, he like said, hey, like, you got to get to the back of the line. And they came up to my buddy and they were going to start hitting him. And literally, I don't know if it's the same in America, right? But in England, when you become a black belt, they give you a card, right? Which you've got to produce. So if you're going to get into a fight with somebody to defend you or a friend, you've got to pull out this card. This is my Chase private banker card. But you pull out the card and you say, look, like, I'm trained. And they're like, ooh, he's got a card. He's trained. And literally, they wanted to start rumbling. I dropped those guys in like 3 seconds. That's the last time I've ever raised my hands on anybody. But I still know I got the chops, right? It's the muscle memory. Somebody comes from left field and hits you, it's instinct, right? You're gonna block them. And I think martial arts and deal making is very, very similar. Like, you did the martial art reps and then those things that they're in you the time. Deal making is the same. The more sellers you talk to, the more offers you make, the more negotiations you get into, the more pitches you do for capital, whatever, that you're building those reps. And then you've got almost like that same muscle memory, right? Like, when I go into a deal, because I've got a photographic memory, like, I remember every transaction I've ever worked on. And I've closed over 400 deals at this point and probably worked on about 10,000 or looked at 10,000. And I remember all the different nuances. So I'm able to kind of relate to what's going on. But I almost said to you when I found out about your martial arts, like, let's spar one day. But yeah, I'm a little bit too creaky now to kind of
We could probably get some gear on, right? But I don't know, it would be too aggressive, right?
It'd be pretty funny.
Hey, so one of the things that you would say, go ahead. Yeah, so one of the things around that, you know, because you mentioned some key things around doing the reps there, right? And, you know, like, I had no intention of, you know, going on the black belt journey. Like, I put my kids in when they were like 8 and 5, right? And got to be friendly with the master. And then he kind of roped me into, hey, you could do private lessons, right? And then eventually it was like, hey, you need to test in a group, right? And next thing you know, I'm in group classes, right? Because I recognized that I needed to be around different body types. But there was this key thing that he always said to me. He was like, hey, Dan, why don't you teach class tonight? And I would say, I'm not qualified, right? Like, I don't even know, like, I know very little, right? And what I finally learned, and it took me till almost black belt to learn this, was you learn by teaching and doing. Right.
That's right.
And you learn from a different perspective when you're teaching, like, because you could see how people react. You could see their different, you know, the way they do something maybe a little differently. So for me, it was a huge lesson of, like, you know, it's like, just get out there and, you know, actually be willing to just get uncomfortable and do something, right? And do the reps. And you know, so it's a different perspective that a lot of people will be stuck, because a lot of people in the martial arts, they'll get the black belt and then they, you know, they check off the box, like, I achieved it, right? It was like, if I had stayed in it, I could be at master level now, right? You know, at this many years, right? But the reality is, like, that wasn't my goal. Like, you know, it's like, one of the things the grandmaster always trained us on was, the worst thing you could do is look down at your belt and believe it, right? And, you know, there's always somebody that could be better than you. You don't know until you get yourself into the altercation.
I love that, right? I love that. Yeah. So there's two things in there that I want to touch on that really resonate with me. I think the first one is, you said something there was really powerful. You talked about getting uncomfortable, right? Mm-hmm. Getting uncomfortable, I think, in anything in life is where you really learn. And, like, one of the things I give some of the new proteges, like, a kind of really hard time about this, because, you know, you'll always hear me say this, you know, execution trumps knowledge. every single time. It's not just about doing the training and listening to the case studies and understanding how all the tools and strategies work. You only really learn when you get onto the field of play and you start executing this stuff, right? And a lot of these people, they're like, well, what if it doesn't go well? It's like, dude, you're not going to die, right? It's not going to kill you, right? And I'll say, well, what if I fail? Okay, now, remove that word from your vocabulary forever, right? We either win or we learn. You either win or you learn. If you win, great. If you don't win, and you might not win for the first 3, 4, 5, 10 times, you're going to learn something, right? And that is then stacking your probability of winning at some point. And I don't know, man. Like, I find those wins are always like, you know, a little bit sweeter. I think that's just so important. The other thing that you talked about is I remember when I took my black belt, and like in England where I did mine, you go up, it's like the Dan scale. So, you know, you do your karate black belt, you're a first Dan, then you can be second, third, fourth, fifth, sixth. My sensei in my dojo, Bob Rhodes, was a seventh Dan, right? He'd fought in the Olympics. He's like one of the like highest, most experienced karate guys in the world in Shokotan, right? And like I remember his belt was almost white. So he'd worn his black belt, and he had a black belt for probably 25 years. And over the years, through all of the sparring and the training and the tournaments and everything, all the black kind of cotton had unraveled, and he was going back to almost being a white belt. And I asked him the question, right? I said, sensei, why don't you buy a new belt? He's like, Carl, you don't understand what karate is all about, right? When you become a black belt, to keep getting better and better and better, you almost have to unlearn a lot of these things. It's like you're almost going back and completing a full circle. And that's really resonated with me, right? To the point where, you know, anything in life, you can always improve. Like, people come into Protégé or they interact with me in deal making and they think, you know, this guy's like the pinnacle of where I want to be. But I'm learning stuff all the time from you guys. Like, were you on the advanced track call a few hours ago?
Today I wasn't on it. Right.
Yeah. So on the advanced track call today on Protégé, it was like, it was crazy. We went down this deep rabbit hole around, like somebody's just done a deal where they went in, it was annuity deal structure. Just before closing, the seller got cold feet and said, well, actually, like, you know, I'd rather have a closing payment. So the deal maker had actually gone out and found somebody that would buy the annuity note at about a 35% loan to value, right? So the seller was saying, well, hey, you know, it's like $1 million deal over 10 years. Like, do I want $100,000 a year or can I have $350,000 now? And like, then we got into like the philosophy around that, which is like, that's a great win for the seller, right? It's a great win for the buyer, right? As well, because, you know, you're able to do the deal with the closing payment. But then it's like, psychologically, if you cash a seller out at closing and they have zero incentive to stay in, if the business is dependent on that handover, that transfer of value, then that's a pretty dangerous thing to do, right? And then we got into this debate around the legalities of it and how some of the other different structures would work. And I went outside of my comfort zone a little bit, right? I went into a territory that I've seen pretty much everything, but every day working with you and all the, you know, the 1,100 of the protégés, like, I learn new things, right? People take my stuff and they'll just go off piste a little bit. Sometimes they go off piste and they crash, okay? Sometimes they go off piste and they win, right? And when that feeds back, we're able to kind of collaborate, you know, even deeper. And that's the thing about Protégé that I think just makes me so proud that people can, it's like teaching martial arts, isn't it? Like, you know, they learn from a master, they do their own stuff, and then they're able to kind of innovate and then, you know, feed that back into the community. So that kind of blows my mind. It's one of the reasons why I'm so passionate about this.
Right.
Final question for you, then I will let you go. What's the number one piece of advice you would give to, you know, a brand new deal maker that's looking to get out there and do some deals? What would you tell them?
I think you touched on this a little bit right earlier, but it's really getting out there, right? Because you can get caught up. There's a lot of material to get through, right? Definitely go through the training, right? But the faster you can get into conversations, right, and start feeding your pipeline, even if you're not clear on your buy box, like for me, it was very evident to me as I started to go through certain types of due diligence with, you know, looking at different types of deals and having conversations to say, okay, well, I learned something there, but that's probably not something I'm really should be doing, right? Or not an area of interest. But the faster you can get out and start feeding your pipeline and really, I think one of the big things, Carl, and I think that you should definitely, if you don't have this on the docket for the beginning of the year, because this was where I had the major shift last year, was that 30-day beast challenge that you did, right? Yeah. Right. And, you know, just getting into the habit of reaching out and having conversations every day, right? Yeah. I do that with the consulting and coaching stuff that I do. I always tell people, just get out there and start having conversations on a daily basis, right?
I'm going to do that again people. For sure. Yeah. Thanks for reminding right. me. Definitely doing Beast 30 in January. We'll probably start right. around the 5th, so it'll leak into February. But yeah, that sure. was really powerful because it sets you up for the whole year with a exactly. bunch of new relationships, deal flow, connections, whether you find new attorneys, CPAs, partners. Yeah, I agree. It's pretty powerful.
Yeah.
Okay, man. Good. Well, hey, I really appreciate your time. I know you've got a ton of stuff going on, so I'm going to let you go. But, you know, thanks for coming on the show today. And I will catch you soon. We got a board meeting on Monday for KOD. So I got some really, really cool stuff that I want to share with you guys about what I want us to do next year. But I'm mm-hmm. looking forward to seeing you then. But thanks, buddy. Appreciate you.
All right. Thanks a lot. I appreciate it.
All right, buddy. See you soon. Bye-bye. Bye.
All right. Bye-bye.